You are now listening to the Someone's Favorite Productions podcast network.
Sometimes you've got to watch a movie. A movie that makes you want to poke out your eyes. But after you watch that movie, you'll know that you got to talk about it with three other guys. At least I'm not the only one who watched this movie. At least my eyes are also with 2, 4, 6, 8 other eyes who also had to watch this really tough movie. We must be talking about June Gloom, guys. We must be talking about June Gloom. Because what would it be? Where are we going with this? And what would you think if I'm put you through this? Bring it back home. It's June Gloom. It's June Gloom.
Let me quote the movie. That wasn't good. That was great.
Music.
Welcome to the New World Pictures Podcast, where we're going to talk about every movie released by New World Pictures. I'm Ryan. With me, as always, is Mark.
I realized after watching this movie that it was probably good that I never used any of the music equipment that's surrounding me as I'm recording this podcast.
And Erica.
I don't even know a safe quote that I could quote right now when thinking about this film. So I'm just going to say, howdy. Howdy, Ryan. Howdy. Hello.
Yeah, and we're a little bit out of sorts, and that's because, of course, we're in the midst of June Gloom. June Gloom 2, Down to Frown, where we talk about all the dramas released by New World Pictures. We're talking about the saddies, guys. Doing the saddies. So, helping us out with this episode, we brought back a previous guest. You've heard him on episodes like DEF CON 4 and Beverly Hills Vamp. He's a podcaster, actor, stand-up comedian, Tommy Bechtold. Welcome back!
Oh, so good to be here, guys. Thank you. Tell you what, I gotta say, I picked a hell of a time to start doing this podcast sober. My God.
So sorry. You would think from that lineup that we don't like you, but I would just like to confirm, for the record, we do like you, Tommy. We do.
Yes. Don't forget, and you guys also let me do the trial of the Incredible Hulk. So
yes, of course.
That one was one for me.
It's not you, it's us. It's definitely us.
I do want the audience to know that I did tell Tommy several times. Mm-hmm. We're also going to do sci-fi after, so if you don't want to do...
No.
And he said, no, give me some drama. Let's go. And I was like... You don't know what you're asking for, but okay.
I didn't know it had that New World flavor.
It has New World flavor. This is the real stuff here. The real Roger Corman.
Yeah.
This is even one that I don't think Roger Corman would even think this is a real sad drama.
No. It's an inspirational story of a woman that makes it to the big time.
It's just a fun exploitation film to go see at the drive-in, and who knew it would age like this?
Oh God! Like
well, but of course we are talking about 1976's Nashville Girl.
All right, there's a take.
Jamie grabbed her guitar, ran away from home, thinking all you need's a good voice and talent. Nashville taught her different. The story of her climb to the top and the price she pays to get there.
I'm 19.
Sure, and I'm 120. So, what's in Nashville?
Did you see that guitar? She's going to be the next Tanya Tucker, ain't she?
A is all the little things you do.
Get dressed and get out of here. Now, hurry up.
Jesus Christ. If anybody knows that I screwed a 16-year-old...
That line sold the movie in the 1970s. Yes. That line alone.
This is a trailer for perverts. This trailer is meant to
Yeah, that is what they're doing. They're like sending the line out. Like, come on, pervos. Get to the drawing.
You're going to like this one, guys.
Music jungle. She reached the top, but she paid the price with her body. To make it in the music business, she had to make it with the music business. Monica Gale, Glenn Corbett, Roger Davis, Jesse White, and Johnny Rodriguez.
Nashville Girl, brought to you by the newspaper. The most important tool you need for whatever you want. Mm-hmm. Every dream you could ever have can be solved by the newspaper. Want to become a singer? We've got an ad. Need a job? We've got job listings. Need to spit your gum into something? We've got you covered. Truly. The newspaper is the greatest invention. It connects us all and will never be replaced.
Imagine this movie in 2026 with 2026 technology.
Right. Well, the whole thing is going to get destroyed then because she'll know that you need a tape. Right. To give to people.
And plus, a quick Google search is going to really take some of the mystery out of her origin, I think. They'll be like,
exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Right. Right. Mm-hmm. Right. For first, yeah, she would Uber half the way anyway. Right. She would never have to hitch. Yeah. That would solve a lot of problems. Anyway, this movie is directed by Gus Trikonis. He's an actor turned director. He'd appeared as an actor in Roger Corman's St. Valentine's Day Massacre. Mm. And but this changed when he got divorced from Goldie Hawn. That was both their first marriages. And then he decided, you know what? I'm going to make a go as a director. And he made three movies for Corman and New World, starting with this movie and afterwards going on to Moonshine County Express the following year. And then the year after that, The Evil, which we have already covered on this
indeed
podcast.
We have.
Yep.
This was written and produced by Pierre J. Oppenheimer, who brought this idea originally to Roger Corman, who agreed to make it. Oppenheimer told The Tennessean in 1975 that he didn't know much about Nashville, but he said, quote, "I was intrigued by the idea of country music and of someone trying to get in." I'm assuming to the world of country music.
You're right.
Not the city itself.
You can just drive right in here.
Why is Nashville covered by all these walls? I can't get in.
It's impenetrable.
It's a fortress, this city. It seems to me that country music has been around for a long time, you think? But it was about a year ago that it hit really big. And you could say it hit big a year before. But also you could say that country music really hit earlier in 1975 because Robert Altman's Nashville was released in the summer of 1975. And, was that particularly an inspiration on what becomes Nashville Girl? Who could say? Who could say? In fact, someone did even ask that to Oppenheimer, who said, no, not at all. He said, quote, "Nashville was more one man's concept. This movie has a heavier storyline and will offer a more personal point of view to get to know the character." Spoken like somebody who hasn't seen Nashville.
And I was going to say, his father was Robert Oppenheimer, right? The architect of the nuclear bomb, right?
Yes. As depicted in an Academy Award winning film.
Pierre, come here. I want to show you something. No, Dad, I'm too busy trying to figure out how to get to Nashville. I've always been vexed by how you get to that city.
Oh, he was so disappointed.
I'm smart too, father. I'm smart too.
I create worlds. You destroy them.
You have your bombs, Daddy. I'm going to make my movies.
But first, I have to figure out how to get into Nashville.
Oh, man. Here's where you can watch Nashville Girl. It is on Tubi.
Tubi.
It is on Shout TV. And also, there is slightly out of print Blu-ray for the Nashville Girl, which you can also see, which is how Eric and I saw this movie.
I'm so mad that we own that.
It's here. It's in the library.
I know we're not at Final Questions, but why do we own that?
For this episode.
Oh, boy.
Right now. This is why we have it.
Oh, boy. So this is a giveaway episode. Listen to this episode and then be enrolled in a drawing.
Giveaway of the Blu-ray. What are the extras on this recently out-of-print Blu-ray?
I'm so glad you asked. There is an interview with Roger Corman.
Okay.
About this movie.
All right.
Yeah.
There is a Trailers from Hell sort of commentary where somebody will talk about the trailer.
Okay.
And there is the original trailer, and then there's a fun facts and trivia segment because this was on Scorpion, and they used to like to do a sort of Katarina's drive-in where they have this woman Katarina sort of introduce the movie and then do an outro in the movie, and it's not particularly hilarious, but that's what they did.
Well, it's so interesting because as I was watching this, all I could think is there's got to be so many fun facts behind the making of this movie. There's got to be. It just feels like it was a romp to me.
It had to have been so much fun. I mean, I got to know. The blooper reel for this. Are you kidding me?
I can't wait to hear Katarina's take.
Yeah. It's a good one to riff to, for sure. Right over as it's playing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Actually, I did play that part, and Erica was sleeping at the time and woke up and was like, what is that woman? What is happening?
I was very upset.
So, is she the Joe Bob Briggs of Saddies?
She's the Joe Bob... She was attempting to be the Joe Bob Briggs of Scorpion and Code Red movies.
Oh, just particularly
when they were doing
that.
They would... Yeah, they would... They seem to always employ her for that.
And then they figured out there was that darn internet with all that information in it.
Phooey!
All right, let's talk about what this movie is about. Mark, what is Nashville Girl about?
Pawn shops get a bad rap.
Oh, my gosh.
Sure.
Yeah.
I mean, they grossly underpay you for the merchandise that you sell them, and the loan rates are astronomical and ridiculous, and they're impacting and they're feeding on the sadness of people who are, you know, down on their luck and struggling. They're dirty, they reek of desperation, but, you know, behind the bulletproof glass at that pawn shop down the road might just be your best friend. So,
yeah,
that's what this
is
about.
So, knock... Ring that bell, get through the security door, and make a new friend.
Make a friend.
Be buzzed in.
Yeah. Because you never know. They might pay you to take some of the merchandise.
Okay. I mean, really, they are. You're getting a gift.
Yeah.
Tommy, what is Nashville Girl about?
You know, for me, in the criminal justice system, there are two different but very equal populations. The teenage sex workers, rightfully or wrongfully accused, and the sadistic prison guards who bribe them with guitars in order to assault them in showers. And these are their stories.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. Boy, how we get there, too, was some real whiplash.
Real neck-breaking speed with which that happened. That for developed sure.
Yeah, it was like, wait, what happened?
Yeah.
Erica, what is Nashville Girl about?
Nashville Girl just made me wish I had a sister that was going to come in and try to solve my problems, but not really solve my problems, you know, make a good solid attempt.
So her of solving your problems, you then have to bail her out of her problem that she made solving your problems.
Yeah, but you know, just having that attempt.
But she tried, you know?
She tried. Yeah. She tried.
Yeah.
For me, I thought this movie, you know, when the chips are down for you and you just need a break, that's why they have the YWCA or YMCA. You can just check out for a bit when you check in for a bit. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Get yourself together.
Yeah. Also, the visitor policy and the ID checking, very light. Security's very loose.
Well, they had to have a completely unnecessary male character exist simply to assault Jamie one time. Like, it was like, well, wait a second. She's at the YWCA. She's in the clear. No. We're going to have this man come in.
Yeah, we need to have, we haven't had an assault in like 5 minutes. We need to really get back to it.
Pierre, what are you doing? The script doesn't make sense. She hasn't been hurt in 5 minutes.
We were probably only like 7 years away from Bosom Buddies. So like that sort of like, it takes almost nothing for men to get into a all women's building.
It's true.
It doesn't take much at all. Here's the Letterboxd synopsis. Here, we are on Letterboxd. So give us a follow there if you like. Tommy, are you on Letterboxd?
I'd be lying if I said yes, but I've always wanted to be. It's an aspiration of mine.
You can sign up during this episode, like many a guest has.
Keep your goals attainable, Tommy, and you have. Good job.
I just don't know how to articulate how I feel about movies. It's so intimidating to put it on Letterboxd. People can find it. If I ever become famous someday, people will go back. They'll see that I've seen Nashville Girl and I loved it.
Well, you know what? The funny thing is on Letterboxd is many people just log the movie and don't write about it at all.
Oh, then I'm in. Which... That sounds like a lot of what I do at my regular job. Yeah, that's great. Just logging things.
Logging. Anyway, here's the synopsis. A Kentucky-born maiden.
Their words, not mine.
All right. Realizes her dream of becoming a country music star.
However,
However, she discovers that her single-minded determination has caused her to lose things far more precious than fame or money when she gets involved with a group of corrupt music executives. That doesn't happen.
Well, I was going to say, they're musicians. Call them a group. I'd say like an independent constellation of goons, like just like a network of scumbags. Maybe. I mean, I'm sure maybe they all drink at the same bar, but they weren't working together.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Now, all this said, what we've said before, if you've not seen Nashville Girl, we're probably going to spoil it. And don't worry about that. Don't let that concern you.
You'll be okay.
But you're going to be fine. But here's the thing that I'm going to spoil right away, because if you're thinking that you kind of heard about this movie from what we've just said and you're like, okay, it's a movie about a girl trying to be a country music star. So I'm sure the movie sort of starts with her playing a song and trying out music. No, you would be absolutely wrong. We don't hear her sing for 30 minutes.
Yeah.
We spend 30 minutes not knowing. In fact, we spend 10 minutes not knowing she even wants to become a singer at all.
No.
Yeah.
It is all about, and Erica, you can talk to us about the authenticity of Kentucky here, but apparently girls just like to go skinny dipping alone in a pond. That's what happens.
I don't want to be known as the person who can speak to the authenticity of skinny dipping in Kentucky. First of all, Ryan, I grew up in Indiana, so great fact checking there.
But you're right in the tri-state, right in the tri-state.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, I don't know how skinny dipping was in the 70s, but, you know, later, much, much later after that, since I'm so young and fun. I'm 19, guys. I'm 19. Personally, did I ever skinny dip in a gross pond? No. Did I ever hang my undies in a tree? Nope. That really wasn't for me, but...
You're kind of asking for somebody to take your clothes, but at the same time, where was he hiding out?
Yeah. I don't know.
Wouldn't she have seen him coming from a mile away?
Yeah, right. It seemed very flat where they were.
It's funny that's an interesting way to phrase that, Ryan, because to me, I felt like that scene existed to establish that, like, there's some part of the writer of this movie that felt like we should think that, like, she has it coming a little bit. Like, look, she's the type of girl that skinny dips. Like, it's a horrible messaging thing.
Right,
but it's like, we've all, dabbled in writing it from time to time. And, like, there is, like, a thing of, like, you want to torture your protagonist a little bit. This is a movie that I think the writer hates their protagonist. Like, it's like, there's never been a more clear example of, like, it's beyond torture. I mean, she's certainly tortured in it. But it's like, the person who wrote this movie doesn't even really care that she's a character. Like, she kind of exists as, like, an object for him to, like, have these weird... awful, awful, awful scenes with. And I think it starts with that, where it's like, well, she hung her clothes up on a tree and was playing loud music while she skinny dipped in a pond. How could you not blame an inbred yokel for assaulting her? It's like, that's like immediate thesis of this film.
All right.
I have a pond behind my house, and I wouldn't even dare to dip my toe into that pond, let alone take off all my clothes and submerge myself in the leech-filled waters of the pond.
Yeah, in the 70s, you could still go naked into a pond and come out with something you didn't even realize.
And to Tommy's point, like, she was bothering no one.
Right.
It wasn't a dip that was like, hey, guys, check this out. Right. It was like...
Yeah, to your point, Tommy, like, if you are starting the movie out and you're writing it, you're like, well, I'm writing this for Roger Corman. Instant nudity. This is Roger Corman's going to be like, fantastic, great job. But now you got naked, you son of a bitch, and you're going to have to pay. Which is like, whoa,
now you gotta pay.
Calm down. Wait. This is your protagonist,
But I think, Ryan, to your point, this movie has the fastest titty count of any movie we've ever watched on this podcast.
Oh my gosh.
The credits are still rolling when the when we get our first titty count, which might sound to a listener as like, ooh, I got to check this one out, until you realize that she's playing a 16-year-old. Mm-hmm. And that's a downer on the titty count
And you know what? If you are listening to this episode and you're like, that's no problem for me, hit and subscribe. Go ahead and hit it. We're okay with it. Hit it.
We're okay.
Don't come back.
Yeah.
We're good here. You do your thing. But don't.
And not only that,
here.
But it's not. It's one of those things that they hit on throughout the movie. Is like, this is a child. She is a child. Like,
yes.
I'm sure the actress was a full blown adult, but like, it was.
Yes.
She is not portrayed as like an adult in any way. In fact, they de-age her later in the movie.
Yes, oh, for sure.
Yeah, in fact, Jamie is played by Monica Gale, who, besides appearing in soap operas, she had done work in lots of exploitation films, including working for Ed Wood. She was in 1971's The Erotic Adventures of Pinocchio, which was from Avalanche director Corey Allen. Avalanche,
that is a flavor of Pinocchio that I hope to never try.
But I will say again, Pinocchio, historically, I believe, a 5-year-old boy, right? Like, that's...
Yeah.
Yikes. What kind of erotic adventure should that be? Did people age in dog years at that point? Were they like 35 in dog years? So.
They're like, we've seen that classic story many times, but have we seen it sexy?
No.
And it was like, we don't need, I don't know. I never was like yearning for the sexy Pinocchio, but that's just me. Yeah. She was also in 1975's Switchblade Sisters for director Jack Hill, which we covered in our Corman Graduate series. And she played the character of Patch from that movie, if you recall. She, so she does get assaulted. She goes to church. Her dad hits her with a belt. She's like, I gotta head out of here and head to Nashville.
Right.
So now we're gonna get into the music, right? No, because it takes her a while to get there, because she runs across these truckers, and then cops think that they're doing something with her, but they're not. And
well,
so
the one
then...
trucker tries to immediately assault her.
Right. Yes, he was definitely, if he had been the only one driving.
Yeah.
But the elderly trucker, who's, we have to guess, is only not assaulting her because he's impotent and not for any other reason, is he's like, no, I I've got to take a stand here. I will be fatherly towards you.
Right.
I also love that he's handed a menu in the diner, and he's like, he's holding it in his hand, and he's like, three eggs over easy, yeah. hash browns, coffee, no toast. He's not even looking. He's like, look, I don't give a shit what's on this menu. No. Well, I want what I want. You do what I just said. Make what I just said and make that work. I don't know if it's here. I don't know if it's on this menu. I don't know, and I don't care. You just give me what I want.
For what it's worth, that is what almost every dining experience is like with my wife. She looks at the menu and goes, can I get something that's not on the menu? Can I order something entirely not on the menu? Or this thing that's on the menu, can you make it entirely differently than the way it's described? Mm-hmm. This is a regular event.
And they love that there. That's like they're the chefs in a diner want to be challenged. That's the thing people don't think about. They're bored back there.
She has the ordering habits of an elderly trucker. He also pitches it to them
as, let's go get some ham and eggs, and then doesn't order ham. And then doesn't let them order anything. He orders for them, basically.
So there's that whole part. She finally gets to Nashville. Right away, this country music star pulls up in a limo. She gets in there. He tries to assault her.
Immediately.
She falls out.
Immediately.
Wait, hold on. Prior to that, she is trying to tune her guitar on the edge of a freeway, which I find to be entirely impossible. Mm-hmm. I couldn't even stand doing that if a drummer was playing in the same room. And
she's tuning it to the freeway, Mark. She's trying to make sure that it's
what key is that in?
Tune.
That's in key. It's in the
it's in
405. It's in 405. Oh, is that the timing signature? No, that's the key.
Now, I want to say before we move on from this country music star hitchhiking scene, the end of that scene was the first time where I'm like, is this supposed to be a statement on like how evil men are? Like at first, because like I was like, that would be pretty progressive for 1976. Because he delivers a monologue to himself of like, Why does this keep happening? Like, and I think it's just meant to be a joke.
Mm-hmm.
But
right.
I'm like,
no,
oh,
yeah.
Are they? Mm-hmm. But at first I was like, oh, maybe this is like. Then I remembered who was making it, and I was like, no. Like, but I was like, maybe this is commentary on like the predatory nature, which it is a little bit, but it doesn't work towards that at all. It's like the most overt like showing of that without any depth to it, but like. That monologue was so weird because he's like, they're playing kind of whimsical, like circus music behind him. And he's like, why does this keep happening to me? Mm-hmm. Or why can't I get it right? Or something like that. It's like,
when they inject humor into this movie, it is so like, you miss it because you're like, what?
Yeah.
Like so much horribleness has already happened before we even get to Nashville that you're like, when they try to throw a joke at you, you're like, wait, was that supposed to be? What was that? What did that? What did they mean by that?
Because I think the cops in the diner / motel scene were supposed to be pretty funny, but they weren't.
Right,
they were just like bad police officers. Well, one police officer that was showing genuine concern. Like there are very few allies in this, but there was one, him and the pawn shop owner, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, I was like, when they were, I recognize that too, Tommy, that it felt like it was supposed to be somewhat comedic, but it was like, when they were like, look at those, should we intercede? I was like, please. This girl has had, we're not even half an hour into this movie, and she's had nothing but horrible things happen to her. I hope to God there's some sort of guardian angel that's going to step in for this poor girl.
Right.
Someone. And then they kind of do, but don't. It's... They
she
didn't need that
well,
scene.
The writer assumes she doesn't want them to step in. Like, she's like smiling at the old man for lying about being her father. She's like, yes, good.
He's just like smiling, like, oh, you think you're going to get help, the writer? He's like, oh, you think you're going to get help from these cops?
No.
You're not going to get help. There's no help coming.
No.
Meanwhile, his dad is building the nuclear bomb. Ding, ding, ding. Dad, I'm writing!
Pierce,
please,
shut up! I can't split atoms when you're writing like that. You're typing so loud.
You're just laughing hysterically.
So angrily.
Shut that country music off. You'll never make it to Nashville. It's impossible to get there.
Once you get there, how are you going to get in? Do you even know?
Dummy.
Did you bring a ladder?
Dad, maybe you could blow the walls of Nashville down with one of your bombs.
And this is why generational wealth doesn't last over three generations.
She gets to Nashville. She gets out of this limo, falls, breaks her guitar. She needs some time to hang out. She goes to the YWCA, where she's not assaulted, but almost. Well, it's like a fake out. It's a fake
also,
out.
Also, the man claims he mistakes her for his girlfriend, who has a completely different color hair and different hairstyle.
Yeah,
right.
For sure.
There's no way that you, just because he sees her from behind, he would be like, "That's my girlfriend." Yes. But she finally does go. She'd ripped an ad out of the newspaper, and that's what brought her to Nashville to sort of meet this guy, to play her song and play him her song. And so she finally goes to the office, and she finally sings.
Now, did you bring your tapes?
Tapes?
Yes, of your songs.
I ain't got no tapes, but I brought my guitar. May I sing a song for you?
Why, certainly. Why not? Go ahead.
He signs her to a record deal and she becomes a millionaire and she rescues animals and it's just a wonderful tale.
It's a wonderful, heartwarming. I'm surprised more people haven't seen this.
Yes.
It's a song about friends. Mm-hmm. She's got to be a star with a song about friends. Well, no, because remember when he asked initially about a tape? Imagine if she had just bothered to make one. Like, even with her singing an acoustic guitar, you didn't know anyone in town who just had a little tape recorder. You could have just recorded a tape. You didn't have to do anything fancy. Just imagine if you had done that. Any kind of tape. So much of this could have been avoided.
Even Jewel is going, "Come on, girl."
Right. I lived in a van out in OB, and
you could have made a tape.
For somebody who wants to be in the music business, she knows it's not just like it's a bigger world than you realize. It's like she knows zero about it.
And I hate to defend a woman in this movie, but she is 16 years old.
Please don't.
When I was 16 years old, if you asked me to be prepared for anything, I simply wouldn't know how. Like, I would be like,
that's very true. It's very true. But a tape, you might. Like, even if you weren't thinking about getting into the music industry, if you played music, you might have just bothered to record yourself just to hear what you had sounded like.
Right.
Just out of your own, but she apparently has never done it. Anyway, the man she's talking to is Jesse White, who had a huge line of credits, but he's mostly remembered as the Maytag repairman from a long-running series of commercials.
No kidding.
I'd go anywhere to fix a Maytag.
Yeah, that's Jesse White. He also is playing the first guy. And he is a comedic thing because he's like at the apartment below and he kind of has to go up the top and like pretend he's like been busy in his office or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And again, it's so jarring because it's been half an hour of just horribleness happening again and again. Yeah. And then all of a sudden they're like, "Hey, how about Jesse White jumping in there?"
Yeah, he's kind of a screwball, isn't he?
you're like, "Yeah, I guess." But anyway, that ends very quickly. So she goes around to record producers, but they all want, again, a tape. Damn this tape! If she had only made one tape. But, hey, look, she hasn't been assaulted in a little while, and that's been really good. We're starting to build some time without one, which is really something for this movie, you know?
I recognize she's only 16, but at some point, like, shortly after she meets with the record producers and she doesn't have this tape, and her friend is asking her, you know, "Do you have any money?" And she says, "I've got, you know, enough for a couple days." Now, she has a couple days. She has no car. She can't go home. She's living at the YWCA. I even at 16, I'd be so riddled with anxiety that I would be going into full panic mode. Mm. Like, how... I have to give her a lot of credit for... First of all, she's had a traumatic half hour of life experiences up to this point in the movie. And she's flat broke with no prospects. Zero. You know, job, nothing.
You know
what's nothing.
So funny, though? I think, you know, living in Los Angeles, as long as I did, I knew people like that. I knew people that were, like, perfectly fine to have not a nickel to their name and, like, rely on the kindness of strangers and kind of... And they were way older than 16. These were like men in their mid-30s that were like, I'll figure this out, but I can't have a job just in case the big gig comes, you know? Like,
yeah.
If I'm going to be a series regular or sell my movie, I can't be working at Target right now. And it always like, it was mending because if you are a person who had a job in Los Angeles, like you ended up becoming their benefactor.
Mm-hmm. Like, right.
And I'll be honest... I don't think I assaulted a single one of my male comedian friends, or female for that matter. Not once.
Yeah.
And I didn't certainly demanded no tapes. I didn't want to see any of their material.
No, Tommy, I totally get it. I knew people in the same way, and I never felt bad for them. I admired them for having just like, I am so clear. My vision of what I want to do is so clear, and I'm so steadfast that I'm going to make it happen that whatever else happens, let the chips lie. I'm going to make this work.
And it's romanticized a bit, right? Like, you hear the origins of these wildly successful people, and they fine-tune them to be like, I had $3 in my checking account, and all I did was do acting class. And it's like, that's probably not how that actually went, but it is like, there's something like, the more poor you can be, the more desperate you can be when you finally achieve financial independence in the entertainment industry, the better the story is going to be when you're sitting on Jay Leno's couch, and he's staring at you, and he's offering to take you on a ride in his Cadillac after the show, and you want to tell him how broke you were.
Right.
Just the caddy Jay, not like the 1930s.
No, he doesn't like you that much.
Car, the steam engine car that he burned himself on.
It's not his Calliope, his steam organ wheels.
That's so true, though. I feel like improv, the world of improv, has a lot of people that are like, I don't need money. I will just hang out in the movie.
By the way, could you cover my bar tab tonight? Because I do need alcohol.
Right. I mean, I'm a human being. I do need to drink tonight. I need to get wasted. Also, I do need a couch to sleep on, so if you don't mind.
And I will be eating the rest of your turkey sausage before you wake up. But the good news is I won't leave your house today, so when you get home, I'll still be there.
Well, just enjoying your internet, watching your TV, just
and thanks for
the
all the streaming services, Tommy. Yeah. You've really made a nice place for yourself. You Where are you working again? The gravel pit.
Hey, and by the way, I beat that boss on the video game that you've been trying to finish for a
and
year.
And I saved it for you.
It auto-saved, to be fair, so I'm really, you know. Anyway, I'm levels ahead. If you want to go back, just start over again. That's, you don't mind. Start from the beginning. Anyway, speaking of money, she is running out of money, as Mark said, and so she has to get a job, and she gets one at a massage parlor. Nothing bad could happen there in this particular movie.
No.
No.
That is, nope. Nothing bad could happen. And it's actually kind of confusing here because Jamie's actually fired because she doesn't want to take part in the massages and the more lurid part of the business.
Yes.
But then she gets fired and then she's suddenly getting a massage all of a sudden also while she's dreaming of singing and having a career. And then the guy that's massaging her gets too handsy and he's thrown out. And at this point, this is what we're talking about, because from there, the owner of the massage parlor is like, don't you worry about a thing. But the next thing we know, we see a shot of a courthouse, and there's a judge talking, and I guess she's been sent to a juvenile detention farm? Mm-hmm.
So this, I call this the double neck break, because it's like, she's like, I will not be a masseuse or massage victim at this parlor, immediately is, and then the Seth Rogen guy is like, that guy's never going to get us arrested and put us in jail. And then she immediately is, which makes me think they needed to shoot those scenes and they didn't have the money to shoot those scenes. Because even the sentencing is an exterior shot of a courthouse with a voiceover of a judge sentencing them both. As I assume they stood trial and were probably all... They attempted the death penalty against them because they were standing trial together, I assume. But they settled for...
That's the other thing. She gets 2 years probation for prostitution and indecent exposure. Now, if you were going to go to trial for, you've been, you know, hey, you're a prostitute. Well, that means the guy doing the massage that they threw out probably took the charges too. And was participating in prostitution. So he was like, I will bring you down too, young lady, while also compromising myself. And
you're not
going to
let me massage you? You're not going to let me massage you? I'll take us both down right now.
Right. I'm going to forego my Fifth Amendment rights. I am absolutely going to perjure myself. I'm actually going to put myself in probably prison.
Because I plead guilty before they even charge me. I just walk in.
I'm like, this is so weird. What a weird... And we're supposed to just tie all these... these loose ends together and be like, okay, right, this makes sense. Because well, now we're at...
To be fair, there's not really much in the way of loose ends. Like, maybe two ends, like, of a string that we have to tie together. This isn't a complex plot, Ryan. This isn't Cries and Whispers.
You know what? We had an Oppenheimer working on this, Mark. I think you're not giving this enough credit.
There's layers to this we have yet to peel, I know.
There's layers we won't even understand because we're too stupid.
When I fall asleep to this movie tonight, I'm going to try to pick up a few of the details we missed.
It's going to happen. It's going to happen. You're going to get a lot out of it. Anyway, she does eventually get on parole. And she gets out, but before she does, she learns another crucial lesson, which is don't accept gifts from prison guards.
Never.
Especially when you're warned exactly what's going to happen to you by another inmate.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. She was told. Yes, she's young, and yes, she's clearly naive, but as Mark said, also brave enough to like hitchhike and to get herself out there on her own to like set herself up at the YWCA, all things that I'd be like, I need to get back to my comic collection. I would have been like, I don't have my bike. I don't like this. So I need my tapes and I need to listen to Oingo Boingo and read X-Men. So,
wow.
You know.
Ryan, you are really selling yourself right now. Keep going. Please. Keep going.
Hey, you're a lucky lady, Erica.
Your words, Ryan. Your words. Thank you, Ryan.
They could only be mine. They could only be my words. They would be no one else's. Anyway, but also the prison guard did say, like, she's like, oh my gosh, I can't believe you're giving this to me. And she's like, what can I do? She's like, oh, I'll let you know or whatever. She basically tells her, like, this is loaded. This gift I'm giving you.
The bill will come due eventually, and it's going to be horrific because you've seen the previous 40 minutes of this movie, right?
Like, right, we know.
By eventually, I do mean in about 2.5 hours.
You're not going to do my taxes like Andy Dufresne. There's going to be something far more sinister.
Absolutely. So she does get out back in the free world. Her detention farm pal, Frisky, takes her in and introduces her to Kelly, who's played by Roger Davis from the TV show Dark Shadows, who is a musician who introduces her to record producer Mishmash, who may or may not be a great producer, but he does have great taste in pants.
Pants.
1,000%.
Those pants were... Those pants. Did they just merely cover a boot, or were they connected to a boot?
There was glitter. There was cow print. There was what I assume is a glass rainbow, a rainbow made of glass over his crotch.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he had his shirt unbuttoned down to his navel. Everything about his outfit was chef's choice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It looked like there was an initial design for the pant, and then part of the inner part of the leg parts had just been burned. But instead of it leaving a char, it had just burned the under layer of the pant.
Yeah.
To this other miraculous design. It was this it was so wild. I couldn't take my eyes off his pants.
And then he just bedazzled it. I mean, God.
It was something else. Incredible. Yeah. Mishmash does listen to Jamie's song and he likes it, but after having sex with Jamie, he's horrified to learn she is underage.
Mm. Yeah, but so Mishmash wanted to smishmash, so that's...
he did. He did want to... My name is Mishmash, so...
What did you think was going to happen here? I'm a record producer named Mishmash with a rainbow on my crotch.
I mean, did you think something different was going to happen than this? She goes back to Kelly, and Kelly has no such scruples about her being underage. That's not a problem for Kelly. No. It's never been an issue.
No.
He sets up a recording session. Hey, a demo tape. She finally gets a demo tape. What a long journey of horribleness has happened to her to get a demo tape.
Incredibly confusing messaging in this movie, as Kelly is one of the other few men who sometimes treats her decently, and they play very romantic music when they're together. But he also is statutorily raping her throughout the entire film. Right. I'm sorry to put it that bluntly, but that is what it is.
It's 100% what he's doing, and he's fine with it.
No, he's more than fine with it. He's like, yeah, sorry that was a problem for Mishmash, but it ain't a problem for this guy.
I'm cool.
It's a green light for old Kelly. It's no problem.
Right. I feel like she could have just found one of these lying around, save herself a whole lot of hassle.
Pawn shop wouldn't sell it to her.
Just
he said, come back in 2026.
Is that a 4-track mark or an 8-track?
That's a 4-track cassette.
Okay.
Because you want to make a tape. This is for making tape.
I'm making a tape just in case, because I'm really worried right now if I don't go out in the world with a tape. Bad things are going to happen to me.
That's how you make it in this business, Tom, and you need a tape. But like, seriously, if you have an acoustic guitar and you sing and that is it, you don't need even 4 tracks, though you may, obviously, you probably want 2 tracks at least. But just for a demo, a portable tape player, you could record it on a tape just to have anything to hand people. Like,
yeah.
That was just something she was like, nope, never going to do that. You go to a pawn shop on the regular.
Right.
Do you not think that, you know, maybe get a tape, a tape recorder? Yeah. I don't know.
Befriend the only guy who doesn't try to take advantage of you at the pawn shop. Again, people, go to your local pawn shop. Find a friend.
There's straight shooters there.
That's actually the name of the pawn shop down the street. Straight Shooters.
It's called Straight Shooters. Straight Shooters with a Z.
Well, I mean, the funny thing is, like, no one in this movie is willing to help her on a practical level. It's all of these predatory men doing giant gestures for her and completely, like, maybe well-intentioned, but also, like, kind of uncaring female friends that are like, meet this guy. He's a total scumbag, but he might be able to help you achieve a low level of your dream. He's definitely going to assault you, but he also knows a ton of people. So get in that jacuzzi with Bryan Singer, goddammit. Do you want to be in the Queen movie or not, Rami?
It's like they have that. She has that scene with Frisky in the restaurant. She's like, I haven't heard from Kelly in a week. And she's like, well, I told you. I was like, you introduced her to
him. You suggested this, Frisky.
But she did, to be fair to Frisky, she did say, you know what you're going to, like, what you're going to get into with this, right?
Sure.
I mean, she did give her the, like, wink.
She does.
This is not going to go
care for her
exactly the way you want it to. Right. Yeah.
Right. But, you know, if you are bringing someone poison, you're like, this is poison. Mm-hmm. But you.
This poison is also a demo tape for you, so.
Poison did a demo tape. Yeah, they definitely did a demo tape.
They did.
That's how they made it.
Unfortunately, they did. They did. It worked out for them. God knows what Bret Michaels did to get where he got.
Oh, no. We have no idea. We can't wait for that story. No.
He'll tell
you. He will tell you. The tape gets the attention of country music star and young woman appreciator Jeb Hubbard, which is me trying to put the nicest gloss of paint over who Jeb Hubbard is, because my God, he's the worst. And we know this because we've seen a scene of him at the very beginning of the movie, and then we just leave him alone for a long, long time, and don't come back, and we're like, oh yeah, this is the guy that like sings songs and then goes have sex with young women. And that he's played by a TV actor, Glenn Corbett, who did tons of different TV shows. Eventually he'd land a recurring role on Dallas in the 1980s, and then he says he wants to sign her, listens to her tape, and he gives her this outline of a deal.
I heard your demo. Kelly was right. You're good.
Thank you, Mr. Hubbard.
Jeb.
Thank you, Jeb.
I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'll put you under personal contract. But you
never
have
a good
to agree
sign.
To a number of conditions.
No.
Such as?
First of all, you're an unknown. You need a lot of work. Promotion, build up, write songs, write exposure. Not much will be coming in at first.
I don't mind, honest.
Second, you have to promise to do whatever I ask you to do. Third, I get 50% of your earnings for a manager's fee. And I've also got a 7-year option on you and all your services exclusively.
What do you mean by option?
That means every 6 months, if I want to continue, you have to stay with me till the 7 years are up.
What do you mean by years? That means 365 days, unless there's a leap year, then there's 366 days. What do you mean by days? That's a 24-hour increment of time, signifying one day in a week. And also, I'll say, standard industry contract for any of us that have broken into any business is 50% plus your soul.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty much. Which is what they get here. I love that, like, six-month... if we're talking NBA terms, like a six-month team option, we just have a team option every 6 months. We can be like, yes, we'll continue. Yes. Or no, we will not. It doesn't take somebody with a lot of legal expertise to think, boy, I feel like I'm getting screwed. But we know she's going to take it because we've watched her for the past 50 minutes experience all manner of hell to get to this point. And so, of course, she accepts and she goes on the road with Jeb and his wife. Under her new pseudonym, Melody Mason. And you know what that means? Musical montages. Mm-hmm. And lots of them. The songs here, by the way, the songs were written by three songwriters from the Chapel Music Company in Nashville. Mm. Rory Burke, Gene Dobbins. Both of them actually appear in the movie as members of Jeb's band. In fact, Rory Burke is the one singing and playing guitar next to Jeb in the opening song in the early part of the movie. And then also Johnny Wilson. So the three of them wrote most of the songs.
Oh.
And Johnny Wilson would write Love the World Away for Urban Cowboy.
Oh. Hey, Brian, I forgot. There was a fun fact I did want to share, much like the Blu-ray DVD. In that scene where she's recording her demo, when she first goes into the studio, there's a musician named Johnny Rodriguez, played by Johnny Rodriguez. And that man was convicted of murder in real life. Because he accidentally shot his friend in his mansion, thinking that his friend was an intruder. That was the story he gave. But what is assumed to have just been a mishap at a party where he murdered a guy. I just didn't want us to get through the whole podcast until I just wanted to drop a little Johnny Rodriguez lore. And he sadly passed away a couple of years ago, but I know he's up there in heaven right now with the rest of the gang. And I just, you know, when you hit your knees tonight, say a little prayer for Johnny Rod, would you?
Wow. That fun fact is not on the Blu-ray, and that is a shame because they need
well,
to keep,
I just want people to know that when I come on this show, I do the homework.
Yes,
does the work.
Yeah, yes, did I Google Monica Gale other projects a few times? Yeah, I did right after the movie.
Yeah, as you should.
That's the work. The work. You know, that is what it does. That's what you do.
Yes.
But life on the road can get tough, and only because of the movie we've watched so far, we all know it's a matter of time before Jeb decides to literally throw himself on her. And guess what? He does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And no one could be less surprised than all of us watching this movie.
All of us watching this movie and Jeb's wife.
Yeah, for sure.
But I wondered about that. Does she know? I mean, she knows,
she fully
right?
knows. She totally
knows.
We're
not final questions, but yeah, she knows.
Yeah. Because even in their bedroom, like, he's on the bed and she's, like, over at the table, like, playing solitaire. Like, whatever. Look. This is just how I make my money, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. I keep you in line, you go have sex with a bunch of young girls, and, you know, I get paid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I will say the one thing, and I hate to give this movie any flowers, but they establish that this guy's a piece of shit at the beginning, and he stays it, and they don't ever give him any kind of, like, let up where it's like, oh, he's from a different time and he's a little misunderstood and his brain has been destroyed by a toxic industry like the music industry. It's just like, no, this guy sucks from the second you meet him, and he continues to suck throughout the movie. And I'm sure that wasn't done on purpose. I'm sure from Pierre Oppenheimer's standpoint, he's the hero of this film.
I mean, he definitely doesn't change, but he does get worse. Like, you're like, oh, he's even worse than I realized in the beginning. Well, because in the very beginning, when he, like, hooks up with a young girl, like, any sort of, like, musical star hooking up with a young person, you're like, that doesn't... It almost feels like kind of quaint in a way, like, oh, sure, this happens. What you don't know at that time, he's actually been married for 20 years. Right, so you're like, oh, no, this is actually... And we don't, of course, we also don't know the age of the young girl that he's hooking up with. So, you know, but in this film, you have to assume they're all underage.
Right.
Right.
Or, as they say, she turned 17, the age of consent in this country.
I'm glad they stuck a fine point on that, too. That was
nice. Wow.
Yeah.
That wasn't necessary, guys.
They're like,
that
you can be turned on during the sex scenes now. They're like, they're not sex scenes.
You're okay. You're okay to be titillated. It's okay.
There is no romantic love scene in this movie. It is all assault.
Yep.
Oh, my God. So, Jamie does not take to his advances, and so he gives her an ultimatum. Which is like, you just do what I say and have sex with me when I want, and you can continue to live your dream, and that's the only way you're going to do it. Nashville girl, we're having fun.
Nashville girl, when does the fun start?
I thought Hannah Montana got real when they covered a young country music from Nashville trying to make it and deal with the trappings of fame, but... This movie definitely goes an extra level beyond Miley Cyrus's worst moments on that show.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, you really thought that she said all that there needed to be said, but this film really beat her to it, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
Luckily, Jamie's sister was on the phone while Jeb was making his advances, so she...
luckily. Like, what a terrible phone call to overhear.
Yeah, but she... Like, yikes. But does she... Do you think... Well, maybe this is a question for the end. She feigns ignorance over understanding anything that happened and just felt compelled to go just because she's like, I heard something happen, but like he's explaining his crimes. Like he's like, next time I come here, you're going to like this. It's like, well, I don't think that's ever been said in a consensual situation before. And she's like, I didn't hear any of it. It just sounded kind of mean. So I drove all the way to the cab out here.
Somehow got it in Nashville. Yeah. She made it to Nashville in no time in comparison.
I think that she just doesn't want to say anything. It's like if you overhear someone saying something really bad or a really bad situation, you're like, well, I heard something because I don't want to talk about it. So,
I'm here.
You know why I'm here, and I know why I'm here, and let's just leave it at that.
Let's not worry about it.
Yeah.
I wish we could all do that.
About this movie? About the podcast?
About this movie. We should all just like not.
When does that start? When did we start wishing that?
It's too late for us to wish away the podcast. It's too late.
Damn it.
The brakes on this train don't work. So she does grab Jeb somehow. I don't know how. And she gets him in a car and then drives real fast in order to get him to agree to let Jamie go, which he does. And he tricks her, though, by asking her to pull over so he can drive. Like, the naivete that runs through Jamie's family is intense. Like, I feel horrible for her, obviously, and I mean, there's no other way to feel, but like, when their sister shows up too, who seems like she can make it to Nashville no problem, she can go out in the morning, has a plan, she somehow gets Jeb in a car. And that she gets tricked that easily?
Just fumbles right on that 1 yard line. After all, she ran all the way to that 1 yard line, and then oops, down, done. Didn't pull it off. Oh my God!
I think we also forgot to mention, and maybe you did mention it, and I was too busy trying to erase this movie from my brain simultaneously while discussing it. But Jeff does something else kind of cool in the middle of the fame montage, where he has Jamie meet with a PR rep who retcons her origin story to not... 17 is not an appropriate age for a country star that's going to be sexualized like that. 14 is a better age for her. Mm-hmm. So they change her age to 14.
That's his wife. His wife does that. That was his wife that did that? His wife is the marketing genius. Yes.
And says, you'll be 14 now and your name is Melody. Is that right?
Yes.
What I also love about that moment is that they not only tell you, like, we've made up this story, they go into a long monologue about the background that they've created for her, which is like, honestly, like, okay, cool, but we don't need all of it. Yes. We don't need all of these details. Mm-hmm. But okay, here we are. We're getting them because that's what
If you think you're going to get on Merv Griffin, you need that deep, deep, detailed backstory.
Yeah. Right.
And the my favorite part is that she had, like, she was the youngest of seven.
Yes.
And then while she was away, her family died in a fire? You can't verify the story with her family because they're all dead. Because they all burned away.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So and guess what? She wasn't away. She started that fire because she'll do anything to get to Nashville.
Yeah, and so that's why she has a song about friends, because that's all she has left.
That's right. It's not called family.
And her fake backstory is no more or less tragic than her actual life.
That's right.
I know. It's terrible. Anyway, so with Jamie's sister screwing up this save attempt, it leaves Jamie to have to clean up her own situation, which she does in this closing moment to the film.
What did you do to her?
I slapped her stupid little face, which is what I should have done to you the first time you started acting uppity.
You ain't gonna slap her again. You ain't gonna slap me either, because I'm through. You don't own me.
Oh, yes, I do. I've got you under contract for another 5 years, and you're gonna do what I tell you to do.
Well, if being Melody Mason means singing to your tune, you could take back your contract. You can take back your royalties, and you could take back your whole goddamn character that you created. I can go back to being Jamie Barker, and if that means starting all over again, then that's what I'll do. I can make it on talent alone, and if I can't, I'll find some other way of earning a living.
I just can't walk out of your contract.
Jeb, you know what you can do with your contract. You can take your contract and shove it up your ass.
Yes. What happened to the bird budget at the end of that scene? Because they were squawking through the first 30 seconds of it, and then nothing.
They turned to the bird guy like, what's going on here? He's like, I don't know. I don't know.
I don't have a tape. I don't have a demo tape. I only make them organically, and my throat's dry.
We're imagining they turn and a guy is just holding a boom mic. He's just covered in birds. He's just like, what do I do? What do I do? They're just all
I'm
over.
Trying. They're just quiet.
They're all sleeping. They all got tired.
Oh, man. Oh, my God. Yeah, I love what she says about her contract. It is a cute and fun way to feel like she's empowered, but also an incorrect way to do a dissolution of a contract. You can't put it up somebody's butt and decide it doesn't exist anymore. There are other things you need to do to actually dissolve a contract. You can't just put it up someone's butt and be like, done.
There's no precedent for a rectal elimination of a contract, I don't think.
Yeah.
I scoured law books after that.
I see here that there was a 7-year contract and you only did 2 years of the said contract.
Yes.
But the contract went up your butt. Is that right, sir? Well, then, case closed.
I rule she's
everyone
free.
Everyone do your thing.
She is free to perform under any name she chooses. Where are those birds?
I thought we had birds in this court. Bailiff, bring in the birds. That's the thing about Nashville. It's filled with birds.
Oh, so many birds.
Well, Erica, I think it's that time.
I think it's time for things we love and things we hated. We're going to talk about things we loved about this movie show. And then we're going to talk about the things that we hated. One builds on the other, and the other builds on this one, and together we build on each other the things we love.
Yes, we're
holy
talk
shit,
about
guys! I'm gonna be a fucking star. The only problem is I'm just decades older than I need to become a star.
Aren't we all?
We're gonna talk about the things we love and things we hated about Nashville Girl. Mark, what did you love?
We've already talked about it. Mishmash's whole look. I mean,
that's it. That's it.
Scene stealer right there.
I mean, come on.
Thank God. Okay. All right. Okay. Yes. That's what I love too. I don't know. What was there to love? Not much. This is it. I'm jumping in. I love that too. Yep. I agree with Mark.
Yeah. Tommy, did you have something other than the pants?
Yes. Well, at times, sure, the story was convoluted and the messaging was confusing, if not really pessimistic and bleak. But at the core, this movie was about music.
Mm-hmm.
It was about, right? No, it was about assault. I'm sorry. No, I didn't like anything about this movie.
It's hard. It's hard to like anything.
Yeah.
I do think for her part, you know, Monica Gale is quite good in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Considering what she's asked to do, she's really put through the ringer. Right. And you can see why her career kind of goes through the 70s and then ends.
Cause yeah, she's just kinda like, ran away from the industry because she's like, wait a second. I seem to only exist to be tortured on screen or objectified on screen.
Right. So much like the character of Jamie herself, she was like, to hell with this. Right. Like, I put myself through some shit and what did I get out of it? Like, you know, a short run on a soap opera and then she just got out. So let's switch instead to things we hated.
Oh, goody.
Unfortunately, I did say things. It is plural, but try to keep it to a few. But Mark, what is something you hated?
Well, outside of the obvious, which we've discussed plenty of times in this episode, something that I hated is something that, well, it's that the movie didn't go to a place that I thought there was a real opportunity for it to go. There's a moment where Jeb and Melody are performing and you can see where Melody's star is rising and he's sort of watching her and she's shaking hands with the audience. And this was a moment where this movie could have taken a turn and been really interesting where he's seeing like, hey, it's the passing of the guard and my star is dimming and her star is rising. And how does he reconcile that? And how Is he going to let her become the lead and he's now the backup? How does someone who's been famous for evidently many years of their life, kind of like everybody, I think everybody that's famous at some point realizes like, oh no, there's this whole new wave of talent that's coming in and I have to kind of step aside. And I thought like this movie could have been really interesting had it taken that approach. Of course, it absolutely doesn't, and he just becomes even more of a raging asshole, and he has really no care about his career or feels threatened by her anyway. But that's a real miss. This movie could have been way more interesting had they just like tried to go down that role instead of like, well, I have just been holding out on screwing you, and now I'm going to take advantage of that time.
Yeah.
Like they went the cheap route versus something that could have been really more compelling.
Yep. 100%.
Tommy, what did you hear?
I felt, and I know this wasn't a trope yet in movies, but they plant this beautiful seed of the pawn shop owner offering her the guitar if she's still in town in what, like 2006, and wouldn't it have been the most satisfying way you can land this fireball of a plane than to have her walk into the shop and claim her free guitar?
Yes.
And have him call her Jamie because she's been performing under her own name for all of these years.
Yeah.
And she has autonomy over her life and she's had 30 years of success in this awful industry and she gets her free guitar and he smiles and then he slams the blind shut and says, you didn't think that was free, and then the credits roll because the message is
Boy, that turned dark fast.
Well, listen, I just summoned Pierre Oppenheimer. I dug up his bones, and I made a little potion and now I am him. I have his soul inside. No, but I don't know. I just thought that could have been a fun way to end a really sad, depressing, bleak movie.
100%. 100%. It's
ambiguous.
Mm-hmm. That was my big question for this movie. Was like, what happened to that guitar? Like two times they were like, she kept looking at that guitar. I'm like, that's the end of the movie. She gets that guitar. She's able to, even if she comes in and she, like you said, she's performing as Jamie and she comes in, she puts that money down. Because you said you can get it for like $900 if you're nice. Puts some money down. Buys it whole price, gets that guitar, walks out. Like, boy, would we feel like, okay, maybe it was rough, but maybe some of this might have been somewhat worth it, you know? Like, because she does finally get, but we just get that monologue and the birds, and that's kind of what we have to satisfy ourselves with. Yeah. And then she's like playing guitar under a tree, and maybe it's that guitar. I don't know, but it's not clear. And boy, that would have, you were already there in the pawn shop. You couldn't have shot that little tidbit, and I don't know.
It, yeah. It feels like just a, had it as an alternate ending on the Blu-ray whatever.
Yeah. Well, they weren't thinking about Blu-rays in the 1970s, but I hear what you're saying.
On the tape.
Yeah. Not even video, not even VHS at that point.
On the reel to reel, on the 16 millimeter of this that you had at home,
right?
That you pull out your
for
projection
the TV
screen.
Version, I guess. For the TV, you're gonna need a lot for the TV version.
Got
guys, have to cut a lot out.
Save it for the SemantiCast on what you needed for the 1970s, guys.
Erica, what did you hate?
I hated this movie. I hated all the things that we already mentioned, but I just left it thinking, like, who is this for? Haters of Nashville, the Nashville music industry, lovers of pedophilia. I just, who is this for? Who's the target audience for this? I don't get it. And I don't, you know, I always think, like, after I watch a movie, and I know I've said this a zillion times, I'm like, is it fun? And I'm like, no, this movie isn't fun. So why does it exist?
I think it's funny because it's like a prescient movie in the sense that it seems to be made for an audience that exists very much today that likes to just accuse the entire entertainment industry of being filled with, like, sexual deviants and people that are out to hurt people while secretly being sexual predators themselves. Because they're like, I did like the girl in the pond, but this just proves my point that you can't go to Nashville without having some guy try to bang you. So.
Right. Man. It makes no sense. So that's, I hated it. Not going to my top five, folks. No. Not going to my top five.
I think sometimes, you know, when you're making exploitation films, you are looking at trends and things that are popular, and you're trying to exploit them for a drive-in audience at that point in time in the 70s. And sometimes you do that, and you know what? You get some gold. And sometimes you get just what this is. Just an exploitative effort to just capitalize on country music trends. And that's it. And it had no high ambition at all. So this is what you get. And you just... And on top of it, I think it just... There's one thing about nudity, and there's another thing where, like, assault is happening again and again and again. And that happens a lot in the 70s, and we've watched a lot of those kinds of movies, but usually when that assault happens, and even in, like, an exploitation film, eventually that is turned into a, like, what they call a rape revenge film. And you then she's like, all right, well, I'm not taking this shit anymore. Well, she took that shit for, like, nearly 90 minutes. She really did take that shit. At the tail end, she maybe puts up a small fight and then says, fuck all y'all. But, like, that's the closing moments, you know?
Yeah.
It's, like, hard to feel like that she got that autonomy for herself and you can feel good about what you just watched or feel good about yourself.
Yeah.
That's the tough part. That said, let's move on to our favorite scene.
Oh, man.
Mark, what was your favorite scene?
My favorite scene was the diner scene, and I know we already talked about ordering food that's not on the menu, but there's something about the 70s and them pulling up and saying, let's get some ham and eggs, which they don't order. Then he orders some eggs, hash browns, no toast, and coffee. The other guy just orders sausages. Just sausages. And then... The old guy, what a creep. That is the sure sign that you are a psychopath. But also,
even the waitress is like, really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, oh, God, your shit is going to smell so bad tomorrow. But in the 1970s, we also had at diners these cups that were not coffee mugs and not teacups. There was something in the middle. It was like 5.5 ounces of coffee that you got in this cup. They don't exist anymore. And I do remember them as a child. Yeah. And it's just...
Well, because our grandparents had them, Mark.
Yeah, I know. And
they
had
those. There's little... They're like... Yeah, it's not an espresso cup. It's bigger than espresso. But it's not an actual mug.
But it's also sort of shaped like a teacup. Because it's rounded.
Yeah.
And you're like, this is a trend that's never come back. And I just sort of, I liked watching that. It was also the one scene that, you know, she got a milkshake. And that's pretty good. It was ordered for her. I know that much. That much I can prove.
Yeah, we can't prove she actually got the milkshake. Right. But she did get to at least enjoy the idea of one, even if she didn't order it herself.
And sometimes that's all you need. It's just to know that it's possible you could have
that's,
a milkshake.
That's how much we're trying to glom onto anything positive in this film.
Exactly.
We're creating potential positivity.
Yeah.
Tommy, what was your favorite scene?
I mean, how do you just choose one single rose from a beautiful garden like this? But,
every rose has its thorns as well. I mean, you know.
For me, the movie hit a high point when Jamie's three idiot brothers chased her assaulter down a country road in their car, and what I assumed was going to be the tragic death of all of them, but it just ended up them beating him to death, I presume. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I mean, they don't really show it. Also,
they don't. Yeah, we don't know the aftermath.
It's another one of those things that's like, do they know what he did, or did they just not like that he was looking at her? Why did they do that? Is it just they're hot-headed? Why didn't they come to Nashville to take care of Jeb, even though it was threatened? But I thought it was fun that they beat up a rapist, so I was into it.
Also, when they take off, they yell that they'll be back home soon to one of the moms. And the mom says, well, dinner's at 2:30. And I'm like, is this country dinner, which is really lunch, in which case that's a really late lunch? Or is it city dinner, in which case you're eating dinner at 2:30 in the afternoon?
Well,
I was really confused.
There's a C storyline about her early onset dementia that they didn't really get to touch on. She doesn't understand the concept of time anymore.
The bones are there, though. Despite
that's why she's
this.
Just sitting there silently when her sister's calling her on the phone at the end of the movie. She's just like,
yeah. That story was there, but unfortunately, you know, they had to cut the movie down. So, my boy.
Well, there was no way to assault her, so they couldn't leave it in the final cut. It was just not going to work out for old Peter.
Yeah.
My one note for the movie, could we assault the mom that's clearly got dementia? Is there any way? Can we do reshoots? We can't afford reshoots. Oh, well, I guess we'll just cut that whole storyline.
Just send her to juvenile detention center. That's fine. Just throw it all in there. It's good. No problem.
Oh, man. Erica, your favorite scene?
We already kind of touched on my favorite scene as well. 30 minutes in, when we finally hear her sing and play guitar. I was like, finally, okay. Nashville girl, you know? Small little candle of hope. So that was my favorite scene. We finally get to hear her sing.
I kind of enjoyed having, you know, Jesse White, the Maytag repairman scene there. It felt like the potential of comedy if it wasn't actually comedy. Like, it was the one scene where I was like, okay, maybe this is gearing up to be something funny. It doesn't end up being that at all. But, you know, it was like, for a moment, I had some hope that we would have a break from...
Yeah.
The sadness?
The monotony of the sadness of this movie, which is, like, constant. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, maybe, it's over. But, like, for a minute, I got to taste something else other than...
Mm-hmm. Like a milkshake. Like... Just a sip.
The idea of a milkshake.
A theoretical milkshake. That's what this is.
It's in your mind, you could make it better than it truly is. And if you're able to do that, then you can maybe enjoy yourself. All right, let's get into some research. As I mentioned before, Robert Altman's Nashville opens in June 1975. And by September 1975... The LA Times reports that Roger Corman has made a deal with writer-producer Pierre Oppenheimer to make a film then called Nashville Lady. How sweet. She's a lady, guys. Yeah. Which is exactly, by the way, September is exactly when the movie starts shooting. It's at the end of September 1975 through October. So clearly, right away in June, maybe July, Pierre Oppenheimer's like, well, let's get this story together.
Now,
writes up a script, and they're shooting by September. So,
question for you. So, when I went on IMDb, the movie poster says daughter or country singing daughter or something like that is like on the poster as the movie.
Yep.
Do you think?
Oh, we'll get there.
Okay, sorry. I apologize.
No.
I got too curious.
No.
This is my
downfall.
No.
What was your question, though? I'm sorry.
I think we're going to get into it organically, but my question is, do you think that was influenced by the release of Nashville and its popularity.
It is influenced by another movie, and I'll get there in a second, that Mark mentioned earlier. Outside of the leads, all the other roles were local actors because they shot the whole movie in Nashville, so it's all Nashville actors in there. Even Mishmash, I would have to think. So you look through most of the people on IMDb, and it's like most of these people are just like, this is it. This is their sole credit. And I have to think Mishmash went on to a community theater career of renown.
Well, I was because just going to ask. I don't want to be pessimistic, but where is he buried currently? Because there's no way he's alive.
But the sojourn to grave will be something we can all do together.
Every year, I like to walk to Mishmash's grave and place a single rose.
Thank you, Mishmash, for all you did for us. By the way, this movie does play at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. Edinburgh Film Festival, not the Fringe. The Film Festival. With a bunch of other New World films. This is, I think, in August 1976. It plays with Cannonball. It also plays with Hollywood Boulevard from Joe Dante and Alan Arkush, and Michael Miller's Jackson County Jail. I bring it up just because I'm like, the other entries are like Brian De Palma's Obsession and Henry Joglum's Tracks. And they have like these, and this is what New World's bringing to Edinburgh.
What a double feature. Just like
they're just like
Nashville
all the
Girl and Obsession in the same night.
It's crazy that they would do that. But that's the movie does come out in apparently in Nashville. It opens in March, and it apparently does extremely well in Nashville, and that's where Roger Corman was hoping this would go, and he would, you know, play it in the South, and it would do very well, and so he did find success with it. And on top of it, particularly, he talks about it here in the Blu-ray extra for Nashville Girl. But in 1980, after Coal Miner's Daughter finds success at the movie theater, Nashville Girl is then re-released into theaters in 1981 as Country Music Daughter. Which had to have taken all of 5 seconds for them to think of how...
Yeah. Wait a second.
Stop it.
Oh my goodness.
No.
Wow.
No.
So Roger talks about it on the interview.
Could have at least
said
Country Music Maiden.
Yes. Right, because she is a maiden. She is
Come
a maiden.
On.
Let's be honest. And it's and the line for it. I think that's the same as this one. When she sings, nobody can touch her. But Country Music Daughter, absolutely crazy that they would do that. And Roger Corman was just like, so we made a little extra money. So that was really nice. Mm-hmm. Like it was just like
so that was
so
good for
we
us.
Already. We put it out, and then 5 years later, we were able to milk it for a little bit more. So that was pretty great. That's my memory of this film. But anyway, that is it. That is Nashville Girl. Tommy, thank you so much for watching this movie, for doing the homework,
thank you,
for coming
Tommy.
Back. We loved having you. Thank you so much for coming. Tell everybody where they can find you and what you have going on.
Sure. Well, first, let me briefly say thank you so much for having me back. I always love doing this show, and I appreciate getting to come here and talk about any movie with you, even Nashville Girl. You can find me throughout the month of June and July. I'm hosting the contest, Rochester's Funniest Stand-Up in Rochester, New York, at the Carlson Theater. Go to carlsoncomedy.com for that. And on June 18th and June 19th, I will be in Norfolk, Nebraska, at the Great American Comedy Festival with such luminaries as Matt Walsh and Joe Canale and other great improvisers, where I'll be doing stand-up because I leave it to the pros.
Yeah.
Oh, and one more thing. If you're a fan of Apple Plus series, you can see me as a perverted truck driver in the show Maximum Pleasure Guaranteed. Don't tell my parents because I lied to them and said my scene got deleted.
That is amazing. Yes, please definitely check out Tommy and all those things, and you have to be near those areas. Go see him. And you do stand up all the time, right? I mean,
like, I do stand up
on the regular
mostly on the East Coast, but I threaten to come west all the time, guys.
Threaten away. We would love to see you do some stand-up. It would be awesome. Thank you again for coming. We promise we're going to have you back, and we're going to not watch something. Here's the thing. I can't promise it's going to be good. I can't put that carrot in front of you. It would just be disingenuous.
I can't tell you it's going to be good. I always say this. God only tests his strongest soldiers, and that's what this was. This was a test. And we all made it through.
Oh, we sure did. Thank you so much for listening. If you want to catch up with any of our episodes and our past episodes, including the ones that Tommy has been on, you go to our website, newworldpicturespodcast.com. That's where we have all of our episodes, interviews, articles. Go check it all out. We got t-shirts. Buy a t-shirt to help support the show. We'll see you next time on the New World Pictures Podcast, part of Someone's Favorite Productions Podcast Network. Bye, everybody.
Thank you for listening. To hear more shows from the Someone's Favorite Productions podcast network, please select the link in the description.
The audio commentary. It's a dying art form, but here at One Track Mind, I, your wonky yet affable host, Ryan Luis Rodriguez, analyze film through the prism of these embryonic forms of podcasting, one audio commentary at a time. Masterpieces, crapsterpieces, live action, animation, cult classics, films literally no one has ever heard of. No track is too small and no track is too big. Join me and my guests from the entertainment world as we keep these features alive every other Tuesday. Hey, who else is going to discuss Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey one week and Citizen Kane the next? Us, that's who. Sure, you have to put up with my voice, but there's a certain give and take in this industry. That's One Track Mind, part of the Someone's Favorite Productions family, and available wherever you get your podcasts.